Welcome to Healthy Living, Healthy Planet Radio, sponsored by EarthX, the world's largest environmental experience, and also sponsored by Natural Awakenings magazine. Live your healthiest life on a healthier planet. Now here's your host, Bernice Butler.
Welcome to Healthy Living, Healthy Planet Radio today. We are now near the end, about a week, of our fourth season, and we remain just as excited as ever as we look forward next month to beginning season five of our show. And again, we remain just as excited to help you explore and understand that unbreakable relationship between your health and the health of the planet. Here we look at the hottest topics related to our environment and its sustainability and how they affect your health and wellness. Here, issues like climate change, plastic pollution, extreme weather events, and others will meet up with everyday impacts like allergies and asthma, digestive issues and gut health, cancers, lung, heart issues, and more. So listen today as we interview experts for today's show on environmental justice, climate justice, and health impacts. And today we're going to focus in on the current and trending environmental justice issues. We're going to talk about those environmental and climate justice issues as they directly interface with health impacts. And we want to talk today about fostering awareness and change as we look at the current and trending issues. Now, environmental justice is an urgent and all-encompassing concern that transcends all boundaries. It impacts individuals and communities, regardless of their background, actually. It revolves around the fair treatment of people, irrespective of their race, income, nationality, color, or location, or age, for that matter. In decisions related to the environment, this is important. And by closely examining the links between environmental challenges and health outcomes, we can gain great insight into the necessity of addressing these issues and inspiring transformative change. Environmental justice can trace its roots back to civil rights and social justice events in the 1960s, such as when Latino farm workers in California organized and fought for workplace rights and health safety, or when African-American students in Houston protested a city garbage dump in their community, or when residents in Harlem in New York City joined together to fight a sewage treatment plant in their neighborhood. These events lay the foundation for the 1982 protest in Warren County, North Carolina, which many people point to as the seminal event that truly launched the environmental justice movement. There, local residents of color organized protest over a state decision to move contaminated soil from roadsides along the state to a landfill in Warren County, one of only a few counties in North Carolina with a majority black population. And so while they were ultimately unsuccessful in their efforts, the Warren County protest and those organizers really helped spark a far larger movement that started gaining national momentum and attention. The movement was aided greatly by data from landmark reports by the U.S. Government Accountability Office in 1983 and the United Church of Christ in 1987. Each of those studies found that hazardous and toxic waste sites were much more likely to be located near Black and Latino communities, and that race, more so than socioeconomic status, was the important predictor of where the toxic sites were located. In the 1990s, the environmental justice movement continued to grow across the country by building alliances with other environmental and social justice organizations. And in 1994, the movement was formally recognized at the federal level when President Clinton signed Executive Order 12898, which established environmental justice offices within the EPA, the Department of Justice, as well as other federal agencies. And today, environmental justice continues to grow, evolve, and it's getting integrated into official public policy. The groups which emerged from this movement on all levels of society, that is grassroots, regional, and international, give countless people a voice in their fight against environmental, health, and social injustices. Now, the environmental justice movement has broadened the perspective of the environment way beyond the scope of conservation and preservation of natural resources, and it has defined the environment as where we live, work, play, learn, and pray. The environmental justice movement is an intergenerational, multiracial, and international movement that promotes environmental, economic, and social justice by recognizing the direct link between economic, environmental, and health issues, and demanding a safe, clean community and workplace environment. The term environmental justice, again, was coined in the early 1990s by a group of activists, academics, lawyers, and community members who were concerned about how race and class impacted people's exposure to toxic pollution. And the concept is based on the idea that communities with higher concentration of polluting industries are indeed disproportionately affected by health problems caused by air, water, soil, or other pollutants. But the reality of today, which I think just about most of us have become to realize and certainly accept, is that all of these issues don't stop at the census tract or the city or the county line. Increasingly, we like to say it's coming for all of us. This is borne out and finally entered the consciousness of most people as over the years, usually in the summer, we hear about the Saharan red dust, and we can see it in many places. And so we all have to think that if that red dust can float all the way from the Sahara in Africa over here to the U.S., right to our own zip codes, then so can many other, or should I say all other, pollutants. Now, one of the most foremost issues in environmental justice today revolves around the equitable distribution of resources and opportunities. Throughout history, marginalized communities, including low-income families and people of color, have borne the brunt of environmental hazards while having limited access to the benefits of a clean environment. Ongoing efforts aim to rectify this disparity, ensuring that these communities receive their fair share of resources and opportunities. And then there's climate change with its disproportionate impact. Climate change stands as a major environmental justice issue today. It exacerbates pre-existing social and economic inequalities, disproportionately affecting marginalized communities, as well as youth and children. Rising temperatures, extreme weather events, and shifting precipitation patterns pose significant health risks, particularly for vulnerable groups such as, again, children, the elderly, and individuals with pre-existing health conditions. And those three groups can be all across the spectrum, not necessarily limited to low-income and minority individuals. And then there's the inseparable link between health and environmental justice. This is an inextricable link between these two factors, and it is indeed undeniable. Exposure to environmental hazards such as air pollution, tainted water sources, toxic chemicals can have severe and lasting health consequences. And these risks are often heightened in disadvantaged communities due to factors such as their proximity to industrial facilities or their lack of access to healthcare services. So addressing environmental justice concerns, therefore, is not merely about justice, but it is indeed an essential step toward improving public health outcomes and reducing health disparities. And again, it affects us all. Now, this is a lot. But here today to help us unpack this are two experts who are going to make us smarter. Today we have with us Michael Girard. Michael is the Andrew Sabin Professor of Professional Practice at Columbia Law School, where he teaches courses on environmental and energy law. Michael is also former chair of the faculty of Columbia's Earth Institute, and he practiced environmental law in New York City full-time from 1979 to 2008. Michael was the 2004 through 2005 chair of the American Bar Association's section of Environment, Energy, and Resources, and he is author or editor of 14 books, including Environmental Law Practice Guide, Brownfields Law and Practice, and Global Climate Change and U.S. Law. Welcome, Michael. And did I get all of that right?
Yes, you did. Good to be with you, Bernice.
Thank you. And our other guest who's going to make us smarter is Maya Van Rossum. Maya is an activist, an attorney, a strategist, and community organizer, and she is the founder of Green Amendments for the Generations. And this is a grassroots nonprofit organization inspiring a nationwide movement to secure constitutional recognition and protection of environmental rights in every state and ultimately at the federal level. Maya is also the Delaware Riverkeeper, leading the watershed-based advocacy organization, the Delaware Riverkeeper Network, for over 30 years in its effort to protect the health of the Delaware River. Maya is also author of The Green Amendment, The People's Fight for a Clean, Safe, and Healthy Environment. And since launching Green Amendments for the Generations, constitutional amendments have been proposed in 15 states. Welcome, Maya. And did I get all of that right?
You did get all of that right. Thank you so much. Just one addition. In addition to the 15 states where Green Amendments are proposed, just about 2 years ago, we secured passage of a Green Amendment in the state of New York, which adds to Pennsylvania and Montana, which are the other two states that have a Green Amendment already.
Indeed. Thank you. You all do amazing work. And again, thank you all for being with us today. We are going to go to break now, and right on the other side of that, we'll be back with these two experts to make us smarter. Thank you all. We want to give a shout out now to our sponsors. That is Natural Awakenings, Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex Magazine, the Green, Healthy, and Sustainable Living Authority for the DFW Metroplex and North Texas communities. Print issues of Natural Awakenings can be found in all HEB markets, all natural grocers, all central markets, sunflower shops, and many, many other locations, as well as available free for download online at nadallas.com. Check them out. Our other sponsor is Lynn Dental Care. Practicing dentistry for over 38 years with a holistic approach, non-mercury, looking at the whole body. Specializing in periodontics, Dr. Lynn is board certified by the International Academy of Oral Medicine and Toxicology. Check them out at LynnDentalCare.com. And our other sponsor is the Weston A. Price Foundation. Based on the research of nutrition pioneer Dr. Weston Price, whose studies established the parameters of human health and determined the optimum characteristics of human diet. The Weston A. Price Foundation is a member-supported organization dedicated to restoring nutrient-dense foods to the modern diet. They are now getting ready for their annual conference for 2023 called Wise Traditions, where nearly 1,100 attendees gather for learning, demonstrations, exhibits, and impressive speakers, as well as delicious nutritional meals. For more information and to register for their upcoming conference in Kansas, visit wisetraditions.org. Thank you, sponsors. Welcome back to Healthy Living, Healthy Planet Radio today. To today's show on environmental justice, climate justice, and health impacts, as we focus in today on current and trending environmental justice issues and look at fostering awareness and change. And we are back with two experts who are going to make us smarter. That is Michael Girard at Columbia Law School and Maya Van Rossum, who is founder of Green Amendments for the Generations. Again, thank you all for making time today to be with us. So I want to start today with Maya. Maya, talk to us about what inspired you to advocate for Green Amendments and tell us more about the organization.
So I've been, as you said, an environmental activist and attorney for 30 years now. And throughout my 30 years of efforts to protect the environment, to protect communities from the ravages of pollution and environmental degradation and ill-informed or just plain old bad government action that really sacrifices communities and the environment, I have really experienced the myriad of ways that our current system of environmental protection laws fundamentally fail us. You know, it's a system of laws that's focused at its core on legalizing environmental pollution, degradation, and harm through permitting. You get the right reviews and the right permits from the right agencies, you can go forth and inflict really devastating harm on the environment, on the community. And one of the serious ramifications, as you said, is environmental racism, with communities of color and indigenous communities and low-income communities suffering disproportionate harm. On my journey of doing this work, amongst the issues that I've had to take on is the fossil fuel industry and the advancement of fracking for gas from shale, and worked on that effort for a number of years. In the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, where there was a very pro-fossil fuel legislature, or was very pro-fossil fuel legislature in place around 2012, there was a law that was passed that really would have exponentially advanced that industry and all of its devastating consequences by giving them a free pass on a lot of mandates and laws that apply to every other industry, and very literally requiring communities to allow industrial fracking operations right in the heart of their residential communities, near homes and hospitals and playgrounds and schools. And as I, in my role as the Delaware Riverkeeper, was trying to figure out how to challenge this law, I and my legal team recognized that actually in the Pennsylvania Constitution, there was a long-ignored constitutional right to pure water, clean air, and a healthy environment. And so we decided we were going to challenge that law based on this long-ignored constitutional entitlement. And long story short, we were victorious. And we were able to defeat this devastating law because the people of Pennsylvania had in the Bill of Rights section of their state constitution a right to a clean, safe, and healthy environment. In the wake of that victory, I identified like what was so powerful about Pennsylvania's amendment. I looked at every state constitution across the nation and found that there was only one other state at that time, Montana, that had a constitutional entitlement of this kind. And I decided that we needed to change that. We needed people to have the same most powerful constitutional protection for their environmental rights that they have for other fundamental rights, like free speech and freedom of religion, for example. And so I continue in my role as the Delaware Riverkeeper, fighting to protect the beautiful Delaware River. But I have added to my work, working with communities across the nation to try to inspire them to want to pass constitutional green amendments, as I call them, and then helping them and supporting them with experience and expertise to actually successfully undertake that effort. And as I said in the introduction, wonderfully, just a little bit less than 2 years ago, we secured a green amendment in the state of New York and are already seeing the benefits of that kind of constitutional protection for New Yorkers.
And so I want to go to a New Yorker, Michael, in terms of the work that you do over at Columbia, or the work you've done looks like most of your life as it relates to in environmental law. I want to kind of talk about something that Maya mentioned, and that is, in many cases, the laws have been used to bring about the environmental justice. You know, you check off the boxes, you cross the T's and dot the I's per what the law says, and you can build stuff like anywhere you want it, irrespective of its impact on people. In your work, how do you deal with that from the legal standpoint? Because again, you got the laws, people are following the laws, and to be able to do a lot of the environmental degradation, how does the law deal with that in terms of protections?
So there are no federal statutes explicitly on environmental justice. And in fact, Congress hasn't passed a major new environmental law since 1990. We've had more than 30 years of paralysis. We added the Inflation Reduction Act a couple of years ago, but that was mostly about throwing money at clean energy, which is a good thing. It's not really an environmental law. Congress has been completely paralyzed by the partisan divisions. And so the environmental justice movement really arose in full force after the last of the environmental laws was enacted. We have executive orders, as you indicated, from President Clinton and President Obama and President Biden. We have some rules, not really regulations, but requirements to consider environmental justice. But we have to squeeze the environmental justice issues into the existing body of law. So we have the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act and other federal environmental laws that we can use, but they're not really aimed at the federal level to environmental justice. We're seeing the emergence of some state laws. New York State earlier this year passed an important environmental justice statute. The prior year, New Jersey did one. But at the federal level, we're relying on the administration to act, and depending on who's in power, they may or may not want to do that.
From your perspective, and I guess maybe your lawyer groups or your conversations, what are considered perhaps legally, some of the most pressing environmental issues right now?
I would put air pollution number one. Air pollution is the environmental harm that harms the most people today. And there's no question that low-income and minority communities are disproportionately exposed to air pollution, partly because of the patterns of where factories were located, where highways were located. An awful lot of the air pollution comes from trucks and cars. And so air pollution still kills a lot of people in the United States, and they are disproportionately lower-income people. So I'd make that number one.
But I think from everything we've seen, the research I've heard about, and people who come on the show and talk to, that since COVID, though, there's been a, I don't know if I want to say a new realization, but an enhanced or increased realization, though, of the interconnectedness. And to the point that, like COVID, while the usual vulnerable populations are overburdened, increasingly, we know, see, feel, and realize that it's affecting everybody as our world becomes more interconnected. But the other issue, and I wanted to talk with you about this, Maya, and that's climate change. How is climate change affecting environmental justice issues? And are there some particular environmental justice issues that climate change is really pressuring?
I mean, you can look at the climate crisis from both directions in terms of its environmental impact and the ramifications for environmental justice communities. You know, as the climate changes, as the earth warms, our urban communities become hotter and hotter and hotter, and those hot temperatures, as do, you know, other parts of the country. But because of all of that pavement and this heat island effect, with the pavement sort of helping to exacerbate the heat, we have communities in urban areas experiencing the heat at much higher levels. And that can have really serious ramifications on their body, on their function, on their health, on their mental capacities, and just the quality of their lives. We can also see how the climate crisis does exacerbate other environmental problems that are happening, like air quality issues, like water quality issues, again, that disproportionately impact urban communities. As the climate crisis creates more and more wildfires, right, that wafting polluted air that is coming not just in the areas where the forests are burning, but at now coming and wafting over into other communities that can waft into these urban areas, these environmental justice areas, you know, adding insult to injury in terms of air quality issues. But then we also have to look at the flip side. You know, what is the cause of the climate crisis? And in very significant part, the cause of the increase of the climate crisis exponentially at this time, in very significant part, is the result of fossil fuel emissions. And fossil fuel industrial operations are very often located by and near communities of color in the lands of indigenous communities, right, in where low-income communities are. And so as those industrial operations, those processing plants, those liquefied natural gas facilities, those fracking operations are releasing their pollution into the air that's exacerbating the climate crisis, that pollution is also affecting all of the people all around. And continually, the fossil fuel industry and other industrial operations continue to be disproportionately located, as Michael said, and as you have said, Bernice, in communities of color, indigenous communities, and low-income communities. And so whether we're talking about the contaminants that are causing, creating, exacerbating the climate crisis, you know, going up into the air and having a direct immediate effect on the communities in the immediate vicinity, or we're talking about the ramifications of the climate crisis as the world warms, and also increasing flooding and flood damages, right? So much of the flooding and the flood damages are hitting our urban areas and literally wiping out communities in devastating ways. I mean, all of these ramifications from the climate crisis, as is demonstrated by the data and the lived experience of people, hits communities of color, environmental justice communities, low-income communities, and indigenous communities disproportionately. So from both directions.
Thank you for that. We're going to go ahead and go to break right now, and we'll be right back on the other side to talk about this some more, because I really want to dig deep into why should those who do not perceive themselves to be part of these communities, why should they care that this is happening to these communities? We'll be right back on the other side with Maya Van Rossum and Michael Girard. Thank you all. Welcome back to Healthy Living, Healthy Planet Radio today. To today's show on environmental justice, climate justice, and health impacts, as we dig in today on looking at current and trending issues related to environmental justice, and we have two guests who are making us smarter. We have with us Michael Girard, who is a professor at Columbia Law School in New York, and Maya Van Rossum, who is founder of Green Amendments for the Generations, and they are making us smarter. So thank you all for being with us. Now, I want to go back to connect our conversation we were having before the break when we really were looking at what we considered perhaps the most pressing environmental justice issues. And one of the things that I really like to dig in on each and every one of our shows, which, you know, as you know, the show deals with 12 different environmental issues during the year. And one of the things that's important to us is to really unpack why should those who do not perceive themselves to be part of these overburdened communities, why should they care that indeed these overburdened environmental issues are happening to these communities? And I want to go beyond the moral imperative because that just doesn't seem to be working very well. So I want to start with you on that, Maya, and then we'll hear from Michael.
Okay, well, I do want to start with the moral imperative because I do think that just fundamentally as people, right, with it really is important that we care about others around us, right, in other communities, whether or not we're directly impacted or not. And so hopefully we have that empathy in our hearts and we want to help. And we see that in a lot of facets of life, people wanting to help feed hungry children, right, and help protect animals who are on the verge of extinction. Well, we need to share that same loving care and support for those who are suffering from environmental racism and pollution.
Do you think, and it comes to my mind as you're talking, that maybe these groups don't get the attention and the drill down is maybe hungry children or things like that because it's not as visible what's happening to them maybe, you think?
I think you're absolutely right. I mean, you know, as you said, a lot of the consequences are health consequences or a debilitating impact on the capacity of a child to learn, right? Or the quality of life. And these are things that one can take time to develop. And as you said, it's not so severe or obvious as a child who is suffering from hunger, you know, or somebody who is suffering the ravages of war. On the other hand, when we see flooding and flood damages and these kinds of harms that come because of how we treat our environment, whether it's the climate crisis or land use or where we're building these urbanized homes, that is very visual. But generally, when those experiences are taking place, it's not just the environmental justice communities that are being hit. It is a broader swath. And so, as you said, that sort of gets lost. The devastating, more significant impact to those environmental justice communities sort of gets lost in the story, that they are the ones that are being hit repeatedly. But I think the other thing is, I mean, and that's really perhaps a great segue, is that truly, we are all being impacted by environmental pollution, degradation, and harm. Yes, the climate crisis is certainly hitting everybody. Everybody's feeling, you know, the heat, the floods, the drought, the rainfalls, the changing weather patterns in different ways. But I think people are all starting to acknowledge that. But we all have contamination to the air, to the water, to the environment that is taking place around us. It may not be hitting us as severely, but it is certainly attacking our bodies. And that is why we do see communities all over experiencing increased levels of asthma and ADHD and even Alzheimer's, right? And cancers and illnesses that take time to develop. So we have to acknowledge, while we may not be smelling it, we are still breathing it and experiencing it, and it's impacting our bodies. So we are all being harmed by environmental pollution and degradation. And every time we can clean up a toxic site or we can prevent pollution to the water or to the air, we are helping the much broader community very directly by removing or preventing that pollution. But in addition, when we change the laws, like when we get a constitutional entitlement to a clean, safe, and healthy environment that applies to all of us, then we are in, or a better environmental justice law or a better environmental protection law, we are lifting up protection for everybody. And so we really are helping to provide the pathway that does prevent pollution and harm so we can avoid the devastating consequences for everyone. So lifting up environmental protections for one community actually ends up helping all communities.
And Michael, what's your take on that?
So no place is immune from the ravages of climate change. Just a few weeks ago, Maui, which we thought of as a tropical paradise, was devastated by a wildfire that was so, moved so fast people couldn't escape from it. Over the summer, Canada's wildfires, which were worsened by drought and by the heat from climate change, caused such terrible air pollution that New York had the worst air pollution in the world, worse than New Delhi. We've seen wildfires jump all over the place. We've seen floods far away from any FEMA flood zone. Devastate communities. So even if people think they're safe, nobody is really immune. The heat waves that are hitting and are getting worse are hitting not only the South, but northern areas. So even though the low-income communities may be especially exposed, there are a lot of high-income communities, middle-income communities that are also at risk. And so everybody needs to be concerned about climate change.
Indeed. And thank you both for that. I think we, as a society, not just in the U.S., but I think as a society, we've all actually come a long way in learning how interconnected we are due to the COVID pandemic. Learning that while we may not be ground zero, we are affected indeed by it happening to those, because I think we can all acknowledge that we are still feeling the effects of some of the supply chain issues that can probably be traced back during the COVID pandemic to a lot of low-income and minorities being hard hit by COVID.
Since COVID hits the lungs and so does air pollution, they add to each other. And low-income people who have to work outdoors or in supermarkets or so forth are exposed, but everybody is really vulnerable.
Maya, you want to weigh in on that?
Yeah. So, and the other lesson we learned from COVID, and some people do really call it, I guess, a silver lining, although a silver lining that came at great cost.
Yes.
We must acknowledge that. But that people did rediscover nature and how beneficial it is to all of our lives, how it doesn't just enhance the quality of our health, right? It enhances our peace of mind. It actually helps. Getting access to nature helps improve the capacity of children to learn, whether they're in an urban community or a suburban community, right? That time in nature, it helps children actually develop sort of confidence in their own bodies and how they work and the ability to balance and run around. I mean, every aspect of our lives, families can reconnect around the joy of nature. So I think one of the things that did happen with COVID, when people were unable to go out into the rest of society, they were able to go out and enjoy the forest or the wetland or the stream or just the little tree and the little garden in their neighborhood and remember how important staying connected with nature is to enhancing all aspects of our lives.
I want to go to Michael now, though. And Michael, could you explain the concept of intergenerational equity in the context of environmental law and how it relates to ensuring a safe and sustainable environment for future generations or for all of us?
So if today's generation doesn't clean up and continues to use fossil fuels without limitation and so forth, these greenhouse gases that are emitted stay there for a century or more. And so today's pollution is tomorrow's, worsens tomorrow's climate change. And so little kids today are going to be exposed throughout their lifetime to serious climate problems. If we pollute our groundwater supplies, often those groundwater supplies can't be cleaned up. If we destroy wilderness, the wilderness is gone forever. So our future generations can't enjoy it. I have two little grandchildren who are 3 and 5, and they should still be around in 2100. I really worry a lot about what kind of world are they going to grow up into? Or is today's generation, our generation, doing so much pollution and so much environmental degradation that when these little kids are grown-ups, the air is going to be unhealthy, the heat waves are going to be unendurable, cities will be flooded, there are these horrible problems. So today's generation has, a tremendous obligation to try to clean up so the generations that follow, our kids and our grandkids and beyond, are going to have a healthful, livable environment.
We're going to go ahead and go to break now, and we'll be right back on the other side as these two experts make us smarter. We will be back on the other side with Michael Girard at Columbia Law School and with Maya Van Rossum with Green Amendments for the Generations. Thank you all. We want to give a shout out now to our sponsors. That is Natural Awakenings, Dallas-Fort Worth, Metroplex Magazine, the Green, Healthy, and Sustainable Living Authority for the DFW Metroplex and North Texas communities. Print issues of Natural Awakenings can be found in all HEB stores, natural grocers, all central markets, sunflower shops, and many, many other locations, as well as available free for download online at nadallas.com. Check them out. Our other sponsor is Lynn Dental Care, practicing dentistry for over 38 years with a holistic approach, non-mercury, looking at the whole body. Specializing in periodontics, Dr. Lynn is board certified by the International Academy of Oral Medicine and Toxicology. Check them out at LynnDentalCare.com. And our other sponsor is the Weston A. Price Foundation, based on the research of nutrition pioneer Dr. Weston Price, whose studies established the parameters of human health and determined the optimum characteristics of human diets. The Weston A. Price Foundation is a member-supported organization dedicated to restoring nutrient-dense foods to the modern diet. They are looking at their upcoming annual conference for 2023, and it's called Wise Traditions, where over 1,100 attendees gather for learning, demonstrations, exhibits, impressive speakers, and delicious, nutritious meals that embody the principles of the Weston A. Price Foundation. The conference this year will be held in Kansas at the end of October. For more information, visit wisetraditions.org. Thank you, sponsors. Welcome back to Healthy Living, Healthy Planet Radio today. To today's show on environmental justice, climate justice, and health impacts, as we focus in today with our experts on current and trending environmental justice issues. And I want to talk now about what we in the environmental field are all jazzed about right now, and that is the recent court win of the youth in the Montana case. And want to get both of you all to weigh in on that. But I want to start with Maya. Was that an example or a template of a green amendment?
Yes, Montana does have a green amendment, and it has in the Declaration of Rights section of the Constitution that all the people of the state have a right to a clean and healthful environment. And so one of the reasons why the youth were able to take on the passage of a state law that prohibited the state from considering the climate crisis in their decision-making was because they were able to turn to the Constitution, this higher power and this higher entitlement of the people, to challenge a law that had been passed by the legislature, signed by the governor, and was having devastating consequences. Just as so many years ago, we were able to challenge successfully that pro-fossil fuel legislation in Pennsylvania because we had the higher power of the Constitution in the form of a Green Amendment.
So had the Green Amendment not been there, they really wouldn't have been able to get very far with this case?
Well, what we have seen is there have been similar actions that have been filed in other states where there's constitutional language of one form or another, but it doesn't meet the essential criteria of a Green Amendment. And what we have seen in those cases is they get dismissed early on and don't result in this kind of powerful victory. And that's because the language is the wrong language. First off, it's not in the Bill of Rights section of the Constitution, right, where we give highest protection to those human inalienable rights we hold dear. But at the same time, the language, the plain language of the Constitution clearly gives the power to the state legislature to decide what will be protected environmentally. It isn't a right of the people to a clean, safe, and healthy environment. So it might say people have a right to clean water and clean air and a healthy environment as defined by the passage of law by the state legislature. And so actually there, you've not created an enforceable right of the people that they can grab onto to challenge bad government action, but you have very literally handed the power back to the legislature to decide to what degree, when, how, if the environment or these so-called environmental rights are protected. So we end up on a different playing field, and we've not been, those cases have not been successful. The one exception where we don't have Green Amendment language, we do have a similar youth climate case advancing where I do expect success, is the state of Hawaii, where they're also seeking a Green Amendment to be added to create an individual right of the people to a clean, safe, and healthy environment. But they also have pre-existing constitutional language that recognizes the duty of the state to protect the state's natural resources for present and future generations. And that language has also proved very effective. And so I'm hopeful and I'm expecting a really good determination out of Hawaii as well.
Indeed. We'll keep an eye on that. Michael, what is the legal community, how do they look at what just happened in Montana?
Well, it's getting a lot of attention. Here, climate science was on trial. We had climate scientists who were on the stand under oath, subject to cross-examination, and climate science won. The judge, after looking at all the evidence, concluded, yes, this is right, that fossil fuels are causing dangerous climate change that's going to hurt the present and future children of Montana. This is only the second time we've actually had a trial on climate science in the U.S. The first one was back in 2007. It came out the same way. But this is
which one was that?
It was a case in Vermont where some of the auto dealers were challenging Vermont's adoption of clean car standards. And in that one, the same thing happened. There were climate scientists, and the judge ruled for the climate scientists. But we see a lot of climate denial from politicians and in some media outlets. But in the courtroom, it doesn't stand up. And I think lawyers have come to realize that don't try it in the courtroom because you're going to be slapped down. It's not going to work.
Michael, what you just said, I think, should be I'm going to get me a T-shirt with it on there. Climate science won. And especially Earth Day or any day, we should have that. Lots of T-shirts with that on there. Climate science won. I love it.
And we have to listen to it. And we have to listen to what it's telling us, which is cutting back on fossil fuels and doing everything else we can to clean up.
Indeed, indeed. I love it. So I want to go back, though, to something that you had mentioned, and that is getting that Green Amendment in the Constitution. Has there been any type of maybe research or study to look at all the states, all 50 states' constitutions, to see which ones, where it is and where it needs to go?
Well, I've actually done that. That was sort of the reason for the founding of the Green Amendment movement.
Oh, okay.
When we accomplished this powerful victory in 2013, and I really looked at Pennsylvania's language to identify why it was successful and did a list of what I call my Green Amendment criteria. And then I did look at every single state constitution across the nation and found that it was only Montana that had something similar. There are a lot of states with a lot of language, but that language, like I said, hands the power to the legislature or declares environmental protection or environmental rights to be good public policy, which essentially is good advice. It's not really enforceable. And so as a result, they don't provide the same kind of protection that we see in Montana and Pennsylvania and now in the state of New York. And one of the things, Bernice, I just want to add on sort of as a follow-up to the ending of the last segment's conversation about the generational values or, impacts mm-hmm. that come from pollution and degradation. When we create a green amendment that includes generational language, which the best green amendments do. And again, we have them proposed in 15 states as of yesterday. It's now 16 states where they're proposed or about to be proposed. Those amendments include an obligation to protect the environmental rights and or the natural resources for present and future generations. And what we have demonstrated in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, where there is that generational language, is that it's not just pretty aspirational language. It is actually legally enforceable language. And it has been used that way against bad government action in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. On the environmental justice front, what we also see from green amendments is because these are rights that belong to all people, the way the green amendment language is written and with that Bill of Rights placement, it really becomes incredibly powerful for advancing environmental justice because now all people have the same constitutional right to a clean, safe, and healthy environment, and all government officials at every level of government, not just the legislature, have a constitutional obligation to protect those environmental rights equitably. But what we are doing in modern-day Green Amendment states to make sure that there's no question that environmental justice, you know, is given this highest constitutional protection in a Green Amendment, we actually are encouraging states, and I'm working with states, and we're seeing it happen, that the Green Amendment proposals advancing now explicitly say, and these rights, the right to a clean, safe, healthy environment, however it is framed out, must be protected equitably for all people, regardless of race, ethnicity, socioeconomics, or geography. And so the power of the Constitution for advancing environmental justice is made front and center in modern day Green Amendment language that's advancing along with the generational protections.
Michael, I want to ask you about one of the books you wrote was titled Global Climate Change and U.S. Law. What is the impact of U.S. law on global climate change? It's climate change is with us, but it's everywhere. We're all interconnected.
The U.S. is historically the largest emitter of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. We're responsible for more of the greenhouse gases than anybody else. China now has more greenhouse gas emissions than we do. Our per capita emissions are still twice those of China and 10 times those of India. Well, the fact is we're not going to solve the climate problem unless the U.S. and China and India and Europe and everybody else clean up. We're all in this together. But I think we have a special responsibility since we're historically the largest emitter. We're the richest of these countries. And so what the U.S. does matters. And when the U.S. doesn't act, that gives everybody else an excuse not to act. If people look at the U.S. as historically the biggest emitter and the richest of these countries and say, if these rich guys aren't going to worry about cleaning it up, why should we? We're still trying to grow our people out of poverty. So it makes a huge difference what the U.S. does.
Indeed. And we just have a couple of minutes to go. I'm going to go back to Maya, then come back to Michael for the last word. And that is, what can ordinary people do in their everyday lives to help drive solutions?
So you can anticipate the part of the answer to the question for me is really getting involved in the Green Amendment movement in their state. Because the truth is, getting a constitutional entitlement of the people has to come from the people, both calling for it, urging the passage of legislation that will result in a constitutional amendment, or signing petitions if you're in a state where you can have ballot initiative. And in the final analysis, the amendment's going to go before the people for a vote. So that's incredibly important. It is also important. I mean, yes, we can do things in our daily lives, right? We can not use plastic bags and not use throwaway cups and not use throwaway paper plates and napkins. These are life decisions that we can all make. If you have access to the ability to get an electric car or solar panels, hopefully government is creating a program in your community to support that for everybody. Take advantage of it. But I think to get the big, broad-scale change and protections we need for all communities, people do have to get involved in government action within their local communities and within their state. Green Amendment, perhaps at the state level. But every single day, municipalities and cities and local governments are making decisions that are either making things better or making things worse or taking no action at all to help people. So we need people to get involved in local government action as well, with their voices, with their minds.
Michael, last word. What can ordinary people do in their everyday lives to help drive solutions?
Vote and get everybody else to vote and help people vote. The single most important factor in climate change law is who's in power, and who's in power in Congress and the White House and state legislatures, the city councils. And if people just sit behind, you're not going to have the people you want. Do not vote for politicians who deny climate change. Do not vote for politicians who are fighting renewable energy. Make your choices and work, contribute to the candidates who want to fight climate change. And vote and help other people vote.
Thank you so much for that, Michael. Very succinct and directly to the point. Do not vote for climate deniers. Thank you all. We've been with Michael Girard, professor at Columbia Law School, and with Maya Van Rossum, who is founder of Green Amendments for the Generation. And they really have made us smarter today. Thank you all for making time for us today. And thank you, listeners, for listening in today to Healthy Living, Healthy Planet Radio. The conversation starts here, but our goal is for it to continue in your home, in your social circles, your workplaces, at the water cooler, and even in the grocery checkout line, so that we can all work together to realize that healthy living is simply not possible without a healthy planet. Our culture is a result of a trillion tiny acts taken by billions of people every day like yourselves. And each of those tiny acts can seem insignificant, but all of them add up, one way or the other, to the change that we each live through. This is your host, Bernice Butler. Thank you for listening today, and join us again next week for our last show of the season on environmental justice and the burden of our children. And listen to our past shows on podcast wherever you get yours. Thank you.